Mobile Farm Journal Field Days was so much fun, Chip decided to stick around there a little while longer, so I get to join the free-for-all and try to figure out if we learned anything from 2 weeks of speechifying at the conventions.
Hope of another week via Farm Journal broadcast. This is AgriTalk. This morning, it's our Friday free-for-all. Panelists Jim Wiesmeyer, Pam Johnson, and Sean Haney join us. And right after the news, a word from Jennifer Scheich from Farm Journal's Pork. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. And now, in for the sojourning Chip Flory, welcome the information overlord, John Harris. Good morning, sir.
Sojourning. You've been doing those SAT words again, haven't you?
I got my thesaurus. It just happened to open to the T's.
To the S's,
so yeah. I glanced over at travel and sojourning was there. Yeah.
Nicely done. Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks for the setup there, Davis. And you told me you got just a bucket overflowing of news this morning. So let's get right to it.
Well, overflowing might overstate it, but lots to get to. Yes, the Federal Reserve affirmed what many had suspected, saying it will aim for an inflation average of 2% over time. In light of that, policymakers will likely be more willing to tolerate unemployment levels which have historically been considered inflationary before raising interest rates. According to Jim Wyckoff, quote, the shift in Fed policy will most likely reignite the inflation trade, which has historically been bullish for hard assets like raw commodities. In recent years, the prospects for very low inflation and even deflation had muzzled many commodity market prices. Fed Chair Jerome Powell cited the benefits of a strong labor market to low-income households, saying, quote, an increase in jobs allows economic gains to be shared more widely across society, including many who had been left behind for far too long. And this Fed stuff is a little bit above my pay grade, but, as Chip pointed out, an average of 2% over time in inflation leaves room at this point for a 4% inflation number at some point, right? Am I reading that right?
I think so, and it'll be interesting to see just how far the Fed is willing to let that stretch if we do start seeing inflationary pressure.
Right.
Given what they said yesterday, they seem to be willing to provide some pretty wide latitude there.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has announced his intention to resign, citing health reasons. The 65-year-old Abe has reportedly long suffered from an intestinal condition, which has recently landed him in the hospital. Abe previously resigned from the prime minister spot in 2007, also then citing health reasons. After convalescing, he returned to office in December 2012 and this week set the record for the longest consecutive time in office. Abe's departure is expected to ignite a leadership battle among the ruling Liberal Democrat Party. And here again, I'm no expert on Japanese politics, but Shinzo Abe has been quite the monolith in Japanese policy and in society there for quite some time, John.
Yeah, and I'm anxious to hear from Jim Wiesmeyer if he thinks this development will have any impact on further trade negotiations with Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, according to a Reuters report, Hurricane Laura has shut in around 100 million barrels of Gulf Coast crude as export terminals and refineries braced for the gale. The Port of Houston is said to be working on reopening, but other major Gulf Coast terminals remain closed. Energy Secretary Dan Brulette said he is cautiously optimistic that the damage was minor, saying, quote, there is some damage to some of the facilities, but it appears to be somewhat light. It is not significant in nature, meaning that the operation of these facilities will probably continue in very short order. Brulette also noted already high U.S. inventories of crude and refined products resulting from weak demand for fuels this year. And if I look at my quotes here, it does look like front month crude oil, across the board here. Crude oil futures with the October down 18 cents at 42.86 currently, November down 14 at 43.17. Look all the way out to February 21, and we're down 8 cents, 44.09 on the WTI crude oil there. So I guess the coronavirus inventory overhang surplus is kind of coming in handy here, John.
I guess so.
Well, the squabbling on Capitol Hill continues as White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows says he was mocked when he reached out to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in an attempt to restart negotiations. Pelosi said Republicans need to provide at least $2.2 trillion before Democrats will return to the bargaining table. Following an exchange with Pelosi, Meadows said, quote, "What Pelosi said to us in the room is, you give us the amount of money and we'll tell you how we're going to spend it. That's not how negotiations happened," said Meadows. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell described the state of negotiations as being at an impasse. And that's kind of my news wrap-up for the morning there. But I'm anxious to hear what Jim Wiesmeyer has to say about this impasse. And it sounds like, I don't know. I mean, you know, you hear things about how Speaker Nancy Pelosi, and with all due respect, it does seem like there could be a little bit more give from her side of the table. John, your thoughts?
I don't think either side is spending enough time at the table right now, and I think they've really passed the deadline of August 1. I think each day that it goes beyond August 1, the electorate as a whole is getting more frustrated with both sides in not seeing some sort of resolution in this, particularly that there hasn't been even a whole lot of discussion between the two sides about this. We'll see how that ends up playing out in the November 3rd election. Thanks, Davis. Appreciate it.
Outstanding. You betcha.
All right, let's turn to Jennifer Shike, who is editor of Farm Journal's Pork. And Jennifer, let's talk real pork. The National Pork Board has announced this week their new, they say it's not just a marketing brand anymore, but it's, I guess, it's to showcase the entire chain from the producer all the way to the consumer. What's behind this change?
Well, I think that the pork industry recognizes that, you know, we've got a really unique opportunity right now. Previous to the pandemic, they were already working on this campaign to be able to show how real pork is integrated in everything that they do at the National Pork Board, not just the meat product that we see on the shelves, but how the product is raised and produced and so forth. And so, you know, they started working on this before the pandemic, like I said, but then pork sales have just surged during this time. And so they feel like it's a really good time to capitalize on that momentum to help people see pork in a completely different light. And so they're telling us it's not a logo, it's not short term, it's a brand strategy that they plan to keep around to help connect people to how we raise pork, basically from farm to fork.
Yeah, and while there have been a lot of challenges with COVID-19, as you mentioned, there's been opportunity here for the pork industry, and I think a combination of both price and availability. Pork has been more available than some of the other proteins throughout this, and certainly there is a price advantage there. But it makes it, because pork is present now in their homes as more people are cooking at home, it makes this very personal, and I think this Real Pork campaign responds to that, doesn't it?
It really does. You know, the other thing I think about it, as people are home, they're cooking more, but we're also getting bored. You know, we're kind of doing the same dishes every night and repeating them each week. And so they're really going to be pushing out different ways that you can serve pork and how pork really marries up well with all kinds of flavor profiles. And so to me, that's pretty exciting too. They're not only going to be talking about pork story, but they're going to help us figure out how to do more fun things at home. And their first campaign, Pork as a Passport, will really help bring a little bit of fun to people's homes. So stay tuned for details on that.
Yeah, and personally, I got to say, check out their website if you're looking for something new to do. They've got some great suggestions on the website. I know I've turned to it several times here during the pandemic. Hey, Jennifer, thanks for the update. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Jennifer Shike from Farm Journal's Pork. When we come back, it's the free-for-all on AgriTalk.
No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag. Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST. Learn how to boost your soil's performance and maximize ROI with Smart Nutrition MAP plus MST at smartnutritionmst.com.
And welcome back to the free-for-all on AgriTalk. I'm John Harris in for Chip Flory, who is on his way back from Farm Journal Field Days. We were talking during the break that our goal today is to say something that gets under his skin so much that Chip can't help but call in to today's show. So hopefully we'll achieve that at some point. And got the usual gang here, Pam Johnson from Iowa, Sean Haney from Real Agriculture up in Canada, and of course the seer of signal and noise, Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers Policy Analyst. And I don't want to pat ourselves on the back real hard on this, but I've got to mention the Farm Journal Field Days event this week, and in particular, the Farm On concert last night benefiting 4-H. Hats off to all the folks at Farm Journal who put that together and put it on. I think everyone was overly impressed at how that came together, in particular the concert and the quality of performances that we got in that. And just if you haven't seen it yet, there is a replay available on agweb.com. So be sure and go and look at that. And I'm already getting text messages from Chip. So he is listening today. We will get him to call in eventually. But having said that, let's get to the big news of the week, everybody. Jim, I'll start with you. We've been through the two conventions, the two very unusual weeks of speeches. What is your big takeaway after having seen both of these conventions now?
Well, on the Democrat side, they're saying, in my judgment, Trump's not fit for office and he mishandled the epidemic. And on the Trump side, he promised to spur more growth and to instill more law and order in the Democratic-run cities. That's the takeaways I got.
And Pam, I imagine your takeaway is a little different.
Yeah, it is. That's why this program's good, right?
That's right.
So, My takeaway from the Democrats is I really like them rolling out plans of what they're going to do after they get elected, and especially paid attention to the Rural Action Plan of Biden on the SREs and ethanol, support of ethanol and trade policy, and working with allies to work with China. And the Republican convention, I watched, and as I was listening to it, I don't know how to sum it up or even how to say it, but it was like they were talking about a guy who'd been in office for almost 4 years now that I didn't recognize by the way that they were talking about him. So the reality of the President Trump's 4 years, especially for a farmer, versus all the good things they were telling and all his accomplishments last night didn't really jive for me.
Sean Haney, up in Canada, what was your perspective on all of this?
Well, I would like us to pass a rule for both parties going forward. There is no more nepotism. I just see little value on the way it was approached on having Hunter Biden speak. The rollout of the Trump family. I think there's other people we could hear from. I just don't think they provided much value in my mind at all. They really never did talk about their dad. For the most part, it was just all the same speech and talking points. It was last night, the Trump speech was a made for TV spectacular. Between the fireworks and the opera singer, and all that was missing was maybe a release of some doves. A lot of people taking issue with his lack of, doing this on the White House lawn. I don't know the ins and outs of all that, but definitely people very, very upset. I guess, if it is true that it should not be done that way, and using the White House as a prop, it's odd for somebody that talks about the tradition of what's in the Constitution and the tradition of how America should work, that they would be that ignorant to what some of the unwritten rules are. Of this process, so to speak. But, 1,500 people on the lawn, no social distancing. They didn't do any testing of those people, and very few masks. It was a pretty, it was a pretty strong message on what the president thinks about COVID. And hey, he's entitled to his opinion, and they're rolling forward and pushing through it. And they really don't see it as big of an issue as the Democrats clearly do. And people are probably going to vote according to that.
Yeah, as I watched both conventions, I didn't see every minute of both of them, but I saw a significant amount of both of them. And I got increasingly frustrated that nobody gave me a reason to vote for them. Nobody. We're in the middle of, and I don't want to paint it too dark, but we're in the middle of completely uncharted waters here in the United States, in a situation I think all of us would agree we don't want to be in 2021. And yet nobody provided any sort of vision of how things will be different come 2021 or 2022. Nobody gave me a reason to vote for them. It was all about tearing down the other side, and both sides, one side I think more than the other, presenting their own version of reality, which in many cases didn't match the reality that we see outside our own window. So it was very frustrating for me to watch these political conventions, and ultimately I don't think anybody convinced anyone who wasn't already on their side.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel too. I think everybody's in their trenches, and maybe more so than any other election I've ever seen, you know, and it's like there's no, I don't like it because it's like there's no middle ground anymore. If you're of one party, the other party, and all the members are evil, and you're only good, like there's no gray. It's all so black and white, and it's discouraging because I see it even locally. You know, people, just even back to the whole mask thing. It's, you know, if you wear a mask, you're a Biden supporter. It doesn't have anything to do with COVID. And yet, as yesterday, we hit record numbers of COVID new cases in Iowa, 1,475, and closed down bars in six counties. So you can't pretend that this is over and it's not significant.
You know, Jim, in 2016, this building of frustration was a winning strategy for Donald Trump. Do you think they're trying to repeat that notion again in 2020?
Well, if you watched the entire convention, which I had to, basically, and I still like it, you saw some interesting things on the Republican side, the reach out to the, you know, Black Americans. And you heard a number of very good speeches on the part of a few, you know, Black Americans. And Chuck Todd of NBC News, who used to be a good reporter, over the weekend said that in his reporting, he has found a number of younger Black Americans who said they were going to vote for Trump. That was a signal. Two is that you say that there wasn't a plan. I would say Trump had the plan. He said he wants to restore the economic growth. That was pretty good prior to the pandemic. And he wants to continue this law and order effort to get this country on the even steel. To be fair and balanced, you know, Biden has a different approach. He will favor the smaller to middle size business, and also in the ag sector. So there's a distinct difference there as well.
Yeah, I thought the Republicans did a very good job this week on the personal stories. You know, having the dairy farmer, I believe she was from Minnesota. They had the lumber guy, and they had the lobster fisherman from Maine. And I thought those were good. I thought they were really good, and they sort of told people why those people are supporting the president. I immensely disappointed. I think people should be that the governor of Iowa was on the stage and did not mention the RFS and ethanol. I just think that's a pretty just terrible omission.
Yeah, especially, you know, after what happened last week when President Trump stopped in Iowa and looked people in the eye and said, I'm going back to talk to the EPA, and once again, we're still waiting. And it is a crucial issue here as farmers are facing low prices and ethanol plants struggle.
Yeah, and in fact, we're going to talk more about that after the break, because we had kind of a for lack of a better term, a head fake on thinking that maybe we were going to have some resolution on those gap year waivers to the renewable fuel standard this week. So we'll get into that and some other things as well. As want to talk, Pam, drought. You're seeing it in your area in Iowa. We want to talk about that and what the crops are looking like there. And much, much more coming up here on the free-for-all here on AgriTalk. Again, a reminder, if you did not see that Farm On concert benefiting 4-H last night, the replay is available at agweb.com. Be sure to go there and check it out. And also, while you're there, be sure to make that donation to the 4-H Forward Fund, doing a lot to help kids have access to the programs of 4-H through this pandemic. We'll be back with more of the Farm Journal Free-for-All, the AgriTalk Free-for-All after this.
Your next piece of equipment is on MachineryPete.com. Search equipment from dealerships across the country to find what you're looking for. Only on MachineryPete.com.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from ProFarmer.
And we're joined by ProFarmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, what are we looking at in the markets today?
Well, John, the soybean market, it's off and running to the upside again today, so pushing out above the recent highs and meal markets participating. But we have soy oil under some pressure, so not all of the soy complex is participating this morning. But like I said, the beans and meal are running to the upside. Corn futures, they've run into a little bit of late-week profit-taking pressure here after the run-up, and so is the wheat market. And I think the difference there is that we're seeing funds pump fresh money into the long side of the soybean market with rising open interest. That isn't the case in corn and wheat. They're covering short positions, and we've just run out of that corrected buyer interest here late in the week. Of note, USDA did announce another daily corn export sale this morning.
All right, on the livestock side, looks like some red on the screen there.
Yeah, definitely. Disappointing finish to the week here in the cattle market. It's been quite a down move. We've rolled over technically and now showing some follow-through here on Friday to close out the week. That's the case both in live cattle and feeder cattle markets. Hog futures, they're under pressure as well. They had been working on some modest gains for the week, but today, with today's price action, we've erased all of that and now looking at some price pressure here.
All right, that's Brian Grady, editor of ProFarmer, and encourage folks to go check out ProFarmer.com and for all the latest market information, and check out that subscription information there at ProFarmer.com. We'll be back with more of the AgriTalk Free-for-All in just a minute.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
America's conservation ag movement would like to recognize the National Corn Growers Association for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
And welcome back to the Friday Free-for-All on AgriTalk. Chip Flory is on his way back from Farm Journal Field Days. I'm John Harris, doing my best trying to fill in for him as we talk with Pam Johnson, Sean Haney, and Jim Wiesmeyer. When we went to the break, Pam and Sean, you were talking a little bit about that it was odd not hearing Governor Reynolds out of Iowa say anything about ethanol in the speech at the Republican National Convention. And there was another twist to that this week. We got notice that Andrew Wheeler, the administrator of EPA, was going to be holding a joint press announcement with Sonny Perdue, USDA secretary. And initially, there were some hopes that we were going to see some sort of movement on these RFS waivers. Turns out it was about a pesticide announcements. Pam, I'm certain there was a certain degree of disappointment that there wasn't something said about the renewable fuel standard by those two agency directors in the midst of the Republican National Convention this week.
I think you're right, John. I think disappointment is an understatement. We keep waiting, and it doesn't happen. And I've, you know, farmers, everybody's been working really hard to call in and get and tell the story about why it's so important to them individually on their farm and to their community to get rid of these 98 waivers that are now on the desk for small refinery exemptions and to withhold the RFS. And, you know, have looked both the vice president and the president in the eye and been assured that this is going to be taken care of. And then, so, yeah, it's disappointing.
Jim, what was your reaction to the developments this week? Because certainly the announcement they made regarding reduction of pesticides was worthwhile, but it seemed odd that they would pair those two up in an announcement on this week when everybody is looking for news on the renewable fuel standard.
Well, they would, I can't speak for them, that they probably think we're too close to this issue, that this could come another day. And I'm signaling here, watch Trump's next trip to Iowa as a campaigner. Okay?
Interesting.
More promises or action?
A decision. Decision.
A decision. And since it's in Iowa, it's a decision that corn growers will like then.
Well, I don't know. Logic has been turned on its heels, but one would think. One would think. We'll see.
All right.
I hope I'm right. I agree with you, Pam. Fingers crossed.
Any idea on timing on when that would come out, other than between now and November 3rd?
I cannot go any further than that. Don't press me. Maybe on the podcast.
All right. Well, hey, there you go.
So be sure to call the teaser. Look at that teaser.
Hey, John, buy Jim a drink, would you, so we can
loosen him up a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, Maker's not if he's going to save it for the podcast. You and I are going to record that at 2 Eastern this afternoon. We'll have it available later on, so be sure to tune into the podcast and Jim drink heavily between now and then, all right?
Yes, absolutely.
All kidding aside, Jim, I saw your chart on the news about what's selling in grocery stores and what's down, and it kind of blew my mind that it is beer and hard cider and liquor that are the only gains, if I read that right.
Yeah, from what we saw before, and it shows you the significance of those additional of the additional money, and it's having an impact there on the consumption of food products.
Yeah, here's a heads up for a lot of farmers. You know, I've been asking a lot of farmers on our show, you know, what are you going to do this winter with no, you know, lack of conferences and things to go to and or meetings? And some have said, well, I'm going to do more snow sledding. Just a heads up. We've been hearing that snow sleds, just like mountain bikes and boats took off in the summer, they're going to be taking off in the winter. So get your orders in early.
Oh, good heads up. Thank you for that, Sean. Well, let's talk about that money on the COVID relief, because we are continuing in this holding pattern where neither side seems to be wanting to move a whole lot or even wanting to talk a lot to get things moving again on some sort of COVID aid package. Jim, are you seeing anything there in D.C. that might give us hope that they might come back to the table?
It's going the other way, John. You saw some visceral comments this week on this issue. So I think on the Democratic side, maybe they're sensing leverage of these upcoming elections that they can, you know, get a far better deal. Now that would hold your breath, mean that we could possibly have to wait until after the elections. I don't think that's a consensus viewpoint now. I think that they're jockeying both sides, and the White House hasn't given that much relative to the Democrat urging that they have to spend more money than the around $1 trillion that the White House has dogged into. Secretary Perdue at USDA said this week that it won't take legislation to get the next ag aid package, not total, that he can tap into that, you know, $14 billion that Congress authorized to replenish the Commodity Credit Corporation. But that wouldn't help the indemnity funding for the livestock sector, nor the chances for ethanol aid. So, you know, codification by Congress is still needed.
Indeed. But and you and I have talked about this quite a bit on Signal to Noise, because of the unspent money for CFAP plus the $14 billion available in CCC, there is some wiggle room for USDA to provide some assistance without interaction from Congress. But Jim, don't we also face a spending bill deadline here that could play into this in is it September?
A continuing resolution, because they won't get all the appropriations done with the agreements before then. So before October 1, that's kind of your, you know, deadline. There'll be a CR, what we call continuing resolution, and it could be morphed into that. And boy, I wouldn't rule that out, John.
Well, wouldn't we see a threat to hold that up if we don't have some sort of COVID aid wrapped into it?
Well, I don't think they want to shut down the government, either political party. The your voters from, you know, both sides will just, you know, throw up their hands and even get more disastrously with you know, this town.
Wanting to do it are two different things.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, you'll have the cable programs at both ends, countdown to shutdown, you know, that just, you know, turn the page.
But aren't there also like 12 million people still out of work and really relying on that money, whether it's $600 or $400 or $200? And what's the need and what's the call out there to provide money for that going forward, whether it happens before the election or after the election?
All that is, you know, very good point to make. The frustrating point to the Republicans is they're saying they tried to piecemeal this thing to provide those additional funds, but then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said she didn't want to piecemeal, you know, this aid program. But then a week later, she came up with the bill of $25 billion for the Postal Service. So all politics, all the time, and it's morphed into this, and it's getting uglier. Not better. Both sides have dug in, and that tells me, we could be near October 1 before we get a settlement.
I want to weigh in on the Postal Service, because they definitely do need more money. Just case in point, I sent a check to a law office 3 weeks ago, which still has not arrived, and my main post sorting place, which is an hour away, had machines removed, and there was a clip on national TV from the postmaster there that just is tearing out her hair because she can't get mail out.
Well, two things. I would suggest you both get Venmo or some other cash thing where you can send checks that way, bank to bank. And two, I went back and looked. Oh, the post office. In 2010, they were in debt by $10 billion. So this is not new for the postal office. And when I really researched it, the primary reason the post office cannot get their act together is the union people have voted against all the major reform packages that the private industry has suggested. And so we could reform the postal industry if it would not be for those unions voting those, you know, packages down, because a number of them could actually lose their jobs.
Mm. We've had an issue in Canada where Canada Post is in financial trouble too. And obviously the post service is just so important to rural Canadians, like I'm sure it is to rural Americans. Yep. One of the issues that Canada Post has is that with the increase in online buying, it's actually changed the package sizes, which is actually not as cost effective for the Postal Service or Canada Post to actually deliver those packages. So that's creating some of the losses. So that was an interesting thing I found out here through the COVID-19 situation. In terms of government funding and some of these programs, it's not just the Americans that are currently out of jobs. It's the Americans that could be out of jobs going forward if some of this programming is not renewed. And like, look at American Airlines this week, basically giving a deadline. I think they said October 1st. If there's no more funding post October 1st in terms of wage subsidies, they're going to have to lay off 19,000 people. And that's just one company. So this is something that has to happen. It's got to get figured out.
Yes, and restaurants, like 85% of restaurants are forecasted to have to close, and there's that whole industry. And there's a lot of sectors and industries that need help.
Yes, indeed. And we'll come back to a little bit more to the post office controversy when we get back. We need to take a break here shortly on the AgriTalk free-for-all. But I do want to throw in that, the post office, you know, all this talk about it being self-sufficient, it is in the Constitution that we have a post office. And I don't necessarily think it should be self-sufficient because of the needs to serve rural America. We'll talk about that and more when we come back on the AgriTalk free-for-all.
I'm Andrew McRae, inviting you to join me for Farming the Countryside, a farmer-focused podcast important to agriculture, and is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Visit pivotbio.com to find a representative near you.
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize Farm Journal Foundation for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
I know, Jim, I'm flipping through research on my Ed Jones account. I'm not finding anything on good sled makers. Did you find anything yet?
I'm going to be researching it right when we get done to slay the market with that advice.
You missed it earlier. If you missed it earlier, Sean Haney had the stock tip of the morning that sleds are going to be big sellers, at least in Canada, come this winter. So make your investment now if you believe Sean.
And Idaho.
Well, Southern Canada, yes. Welcome back to the AgriTalk Free-for-All. I'm John Harith in for Chip Flory, who is on his way back from Farm Journal Field Days. Sean Haney from Real Agriculture in Canada. Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmers Policy Analyst. And Pam Johnson, who has a list of credentials too long to mention, but we'll stick with farmer in Iowa for right now and former chair of the National Corn Growers Association. When we went to break, we were talking about the Postal Service, and I made the point that I want to talk about a little bit further, and that is, there is all this discussion about why is the Postal Service not self-sufficient, why is it spending more money than it takes in. Jim made some good points about that. There's also a requirement by Congress that the Postal Service immediately take on all of its pension debt at once, which is weighing it down, which is another thing that we could go on forever about. But for me, the big thing is that the Postal Service is mentioned in the Constitution. The Constitution says we shall have a Postal Service. And one of the reasons for that is to make sure that every area of the country has access to that communication tool. And I think probably now more than ever, it is important to rural America, as we see more reliance on online shopping and ability to get some of the specialized things that are needed in rural America, get them quickly and efficiently through online shopping that they can't find at their local stores. And the United States Postal Service is usually the last mile carrier for that delivery. And maintaining that connectivity for rural America is key, I think, even if it is not cost effective, which it's not going to be because of the population density in those parts of rural America. Pam, I'll turn to you first to react to that and add on to that that I wonder if the Trump administration realizes the issue that this they're focused on the election side of the Postal Service issue, but not necessarily, I think, recognizing the importance of the Postal Service to rural America, which is obviously a core of their constituency.
Yeah, as Sean said, it's so important in Canada to rural, and the same here. You know, for prescription drugs, for one thing, that many, many people rely on, and the timeliness of that. And I think, you know, in the bigger picture, you look at the things that don't always make money that the government should do for you, investments in infrastructure. And I agree. I think the Postal Service, something needs to be done there for reform because we need to keep it going.
And they I think, over 7 million people.
And it's right there with rural broadband. If you don't have these kinds of functions and services in rural communities, you don't have rural communities. You're lacking incentive for people to live in some of those small towns that we're so concerned are dying into the future. And if you want to make the Postal Service profitable and self-sustainable in a hub-and-spoke model like you have, get rid of the spokes. Basically, all the mail goes to the major centers. Urban people get their mail because that's the cheapest way to deliver it to a big warehouse, and you can drive to the city and pick up your mail. And I don't think that's.
I remember that as a kid. We had to go uptown to get the mail.
Yeah, and it wasn't delivered to the home. Maybe several hour drive though. Like I think this is one where we're maybe because it's been so weaved into the political discussion, we're missing some of the big points here. I think.
On the positive side, our CBS affiliate here in South Bend, Indiana, ran a test. They sent out 100 pieces of mail to the voting authority in that area. They did it all around their coverage market. 100 pieces of mail to those voting centers. Each one of those made it to the voting center in under a week. So some positive news there for the Postal Service, and looking forward to what could be a heavy vote-by-mail season come November. Just a couple of minutes left here in the show, and I do want to make sure we take time and talk about crop conditions in this, because I know you're facing some challenges there in PAM. We've seen that drought continue in Iowa and up into Minnesota. Have you seen any rain or any prospects for rain up in your area?
A really nice shower went through Minnesota this morning, and just a little tail of it came down to us. We now measure rain, you know, in hundreds, so thankful to get 39 hundredths this morning, which is the largest rain we've got for a long time. But like many spots in Iowa, we're burning up here, and corn's black layering, and rain's really important, especially now for the soybeans.
Do you think you're going to be pushing up harvest in your area?
I keep asking. You know, it's always an unknown, but I would guess yes, because silage cutting is happening. And so I would guess it would be early, but who knows?
Who knows? But still, as we saw in crop tour last week, even with the pressure that's there from the drought in the west and the derecho damage in the central and east, still a very healthy yield expected for the state of Iowa.
Well, I think it dropped. I can't remember now, John. I think it dropped to 177.
Yeah, it dropped from USDA's estimate. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's so variable. So the lighter soil, the corn's brown and ears are hanging down if you got heavy soil. So it's going to be that variability when you get out in the field, too. But, you know, much better than all of those guys in the middle of Iowa who are facing picking it up off the ground.
Yeah, I do not envy them at all when they get out into the fields. Well, folks, always such a great pleasure. I really appreciate Chip letting me sit in every once in a while and do this, because it's a lot of fun to talk to you all. Jim, I'll talk to you at 2 o'clock Eastern. And again, a reminder that we will have the Signal to Noise podcast available later on this afternoon. In fact, Jim, we're going to have a little triple treat this week. We've got our regular Signal to Noise. We're going to have that election special that we did for Farm Journal Field Days that I'm going to put out on the podcast. And then also your conversation with Andrew McCray for the American Countryside podcast. We're going to put that out for Signal to Noise as well for the audience there to hear it.
Trifecta.
The trifecta there. All right. So be sure to check that out. Thanks, everybody, for joining us today on the AgriTalk Free-for-All.